serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and one of those stories that reminds us of just how fortunate we are, of just how much we can take for granted, and of how great a debt we owe to our veterans. For decades after World War II, as the Air Force took him around the world, as he and his wife moved to England, bought an old pub, and turned it into an antique shop, even his closest friends had no idea what Al Findlay had been through as a prisoner of war. Shot down on his 26th mission, captured, interrogated, protected from an angry mob of civilians by German guards, shot at by American and British planes as he was being transported. We've heard a lot of that, but the most compelling elements of Al's story are still to come. A paltry diet of insect-laden soup and bread made with tree flour, a POW's euphemism for sawdust, had weakened the 21-year-old as he and other prisoners set out on what would be a 100-mile march from the Nuremberg area to Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany.
We started on a march on leaving Nuremberg on the 4th of April. In the afternoon, we hadn't gone too long, maybe 2 hours or something, and we were under a train trestle, and we got hit with three more American fighters. The first one strafed, and the second one started strafing and then stopped, and then the third one peeled off and didn't strike, so they must have recognized that we were POWs or something. Then after that, we had toilet paper, and we made a big sign out in a field, POW, you know. So, in other words, one plane saw that, because from then on, there was one plane that flew every day, would come and check on us, where we were, and et cetera. I'm glad they knew we were there and who we were.
I guess so, because otherwise there's nothing solid to hold on to. I mean, you don't know where you're going. You don't know how long it's going to take.
That's right. That's right.
You hadn't had much to eat. I have to think this was exhausting to be marching every day.
Yeah. And the weather was bad. It was raining, and it was really a bad trip. It took us about almost 2 weeks. I think we got to Moosburg in about somewhere around the 20th of April, I think. A week before we were liberated.
Well, I'm trying to remember when your birthday is. Isn't it in April?
It was 14th of April. I spent it on the march.
So your 22nd birthday, you're marching from one prison camp to another.
Yes.
I imagine you don't forget that birthday.
No.
Did you even know what day it was?
Oh, I knew it was 14th. I think President Roosevelt had died on the 12th of April.
Yep.
So that was saddening news we got, you know. And I don't think we got it until on my birthday, you know. I remember there was four or five of us. We sat down in a field, you know, and I said, well, this is my birthday. So they sang happy birthday to me. But, you know, on the march, there was several times you're walking along, you know, and little German ladies would come out with a sack, and they'd have, like, potato, and hand us a potato, you know. And, it's just heartwarming to think that they would do that, you know, after all the bombing and stuff that we had done.
Yeah, that shows some real compassion.
That's right.
And, you know, you mentioned saying a lot of prayers and feeling that somebody was looking out for you. But as the days and weeks went by, were there days where you wondered and you thought, am I going to make it to tomorrow? How's this going to end up?
I don't think so. I think, in other words, once we left Nuremberg, we know we left because Patton was so close that they had to move it.
Yeah.
And once we got to Moosburg, I don't think there was any further place to go. So, like I say, on the 29th of April, they came in. We knew something was happening that morning. I'm quite sure. I think it seemed like it was on a Sunday, but it was the 29th of April. And you got up, and everything was so quiet, and the guards were gone. So we knew something had happened. And a couple of planes flew over and wiggled their, you know, and it wasn't long until the GIs came in.
Well, and it wasn't just the GIs. I mean, this is the one camp that General Patton himself showed up to liberate.
Patton came in to Moosburg about 2 days after they liberated us. Uh-huh. I know he was on a Jeep or a half track or something, standing up, and his shiny helmet and his pearl handled pistols.
You're there in this huge crowd of POWs.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And you see this famous general who you've all known about and heard about standing up there with, as you described it. What did that feel like?
Oh, it was wonderful. It really was. Yeah, you had a little faith in our government, in our military then, you know. But, yeah, it was really a sight.
Did he say anything? Did he give a little speech or anything? Or?
No. Just came through and just waved saluting, you know.
So you said when you took off for that last mission, you probably weighed around 170.
That's right, yeah.
So what about when you got liberated?
I was about 135.
So in 3 months, you lost 20% of your body weight.
I guess so, yeah.
So what about from there? When you've had to live for 3 months without freedom, and you don't know when you're going to get it again, what does it feel like to realize, hey, I'm not a prisoner anymore. I'm a free man again.
It was hard to realize, really. They kept us there after we were liberated for about a week. But they brought in the food, and the white bread tastes like angel food cake, you know. In some ways, they gave us too much food, you know. There was a lot of sickness, eating too much. But they flew a bunch of us to Camp Lucky Strike, which was on the French coast. And I was at Lucky Strike for, I would think, 2 to 3 weeks. They gave us eggnog every day and food and stuff and debriefed us and all this stuff. So.
And I've seen a photograph of your POW mugshot that the Germans took. Is that where you got that? Or where did you come across that? Did you get it when they liberated the camp, or did you get it at Lucky Strike?
You mean my POW?
The one the Germans took.
Well, I didn't have that until 2008.
Oh, really?
A gentleman was looking for his people in POW back in Maryland, and he found a whole box of about 175 pictures, and they were all prisoner of war, and mine was in one of them. So.
Wow.
It had my serial number on it. So through that, they traced it to where I was living in Hammett, California.
So more than 60 years later, this comes out of the blue.
2008.
Most of the guys that he found in that file were probably gone. You were probably one of the few that was still living.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible. That had to make your day.
Oh, it did. I didn't recognize the picture at first, you know. I never talked too much about my... My wife of 52 years, she never asked me any about it, and I never volunteered any. She knew I was a prisoner of war, but that was it. Mm. I never discussed it with her, et cetera, you know. It was always a private part of my life and a sad part of my life, but I had to live it anyway.
And after they nurse you back to health there in La Havre at Camp Lucky Strike, they get you back here to the States. A lot of guys have talked about sailing into New York Harbor, going past the Statue of Liberty. Did you have that experience or not?
Yes, I saw the statue. That was wonderful, yeah.
I mean, it just seems like there might be a little more significance to that statue for someone who had been through what you had been through.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. It really warms your heart to see that, you know.
What about seeing your family again?
Oh, I was happy to see my family, yeah. I met my dad walking down the street.
You didn't know he was going to be
there? He didn't know I was going to be there. And I didn't know he was going to be there. So that was quite an exciting time, yeah.
Wow. A picture of that would be something. Yeah, see the look on your guys' faces.
Would have been.
You mentioned that this was a difficult part of your life. And from what I understand, maybe one of the most difficult circumstances was after you got discharged, you went to college at the University of Oklahoma for a couple semesters.
Yes.
And the reason you had to leave was you were having nightmares, flashbacks.
Yes.
How did that manifest?
It was very often. I was back in the airplane. My roommate said he couldn't sleep with all the racket that I was making, you know. So that was one reason I quit school again. I couldn't cut the mustard with a bunch of young kids anymore, you know.
Well, and I mean, this sounds like a real, I don't know if debilitating is the word, but a real difficult reality to live with because you can't control when these things are coming on.
Well, you know, in other words, at that time they called it battle fatigue,
yeah.
And now they call it PTSD. That went on for a long time. I was back in that airplane for many, many, many times.
Does that ever happen anymore?
Very seldom. Maybe once in a blue moon, every 3 minutes or something, well, I will have that. I've felt kind of guilty all my life now since that I came so close. If it hadn't been for the pilot, I wouldn't be here. I came so close to going back there with Bill. I say it was a step away from death, you know.
So when Bill went back to help the wounded gunners, you were going to go with him, but pilot said, you need to start jettisoning stuff and making this plane lighter.
That's right. That's right.
But if he hadn't said that, you would have gone.
I would have gone. I'd taken one step to go when he grabbed my hat. So I was that close to death.
And you would have gone down with the plane.
Sure, yeah. Everything happened so fast, you know. You didn't have really time to think, you know. Bill's gone back. Nobody knows how the three in the rear were, you other than he. He went back the first to check the cables, and he's found them wounded. And then he came forward and told us, and then we went right back again. And he was the only one on the crew that was married and had a child.
So when you say you felt guilty, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes you wish you would have gone back and Bill would have survived.
Yes.
And do you know, were their bodies ever found?
Yes, they were buried. You know, when the pilot came in to camp and we saw him again, he didn't really know that all of them had been killed, you know. And so that broke him up too, you know. And he said that he was going to put Bill in for a medal when he got back to the States, because he should have got the Medal of Honor, really, back there tending to them, and gave his life doing that, you know.
Yeah.
I've never known where he got a medal or not, you know.
And as far as your story, you had turned down a chance to stay in the Air Corps and get a higher rank. You go to college. You told us these flashbacks, this PTSD 70-plus years ago, changes that course. So you re-enlist. You end up putting a total of 29 years in the Air Force, and really, you saw most of the world that way.
It was,
right?
Isn't it? Yeah.
The Pacific, Asia, Europe, South America.
I've had a wonderful life in the service, yeah. Very, 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 very fortunate.
And when you say you felt guilty about Bill, I'm wondering if you talk about the wonderful life you've had. Have you had a sense of trying to make the most of your life in light of what happened to Bill and those other three?
I think so. I've had a guilty feeling ever since that happened. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I just couldn't get rid of it, you know. And I think when I got those plaques, I had a plaque put up on the wall about 2 years ago.
And we're talking right here where we're sitting at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum. So there's a wall near the entrance with all these plaques that list the names of different servicemen. So you had your name put up there.
I had my name put up and my service up, yes.
So that'll be here long after you're gone.
That's right. That's right.
But then you had another idea.
Yes, I did. I decided that to get plaques for each one of those and have them positioned where each one touched my plaque, and that we would be back together again after 70 some years. And that's happened, and I think a big relief has been taken off of my shoulders for doing that.
That's not free. That costs some money to do that.
That's beside the point.
Well, that is my point.
Okay.
Because what you got from doing that, from honoring those guys from your crew who aren't here anymore. Sounds like that satisfaction and that maybe closure that you developed from that is priceless.
I do feel that way, yes.
I'm sure there's tons of other stories we haven't had time to get into, but I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story. I'm pretty sure that Bill and those other three fallen brothers of yours would be really proud of what you're doing.
I hope so.
Do you ever get a chance to tell that story, to talk about them when you're here as a docent at the museum?
No. It's something that's kind of private, you know. Until 2008, when I got the letter and the POW picture, and that seemed to open everything. I made copies of the POW picture and sent them to all my friends, and most of them didn't know I was a POW. my commanding officer, when I was in Brazil, I sent one of them to him, and he came back to me and says, a tidbit? He says, you never told us you were a prisoner of war, but it was just, you know, it was private.
You know, the fact that you come here every Thursday afternoon and volunteer your time at the Veterans Museum tells me that you care about passing stories on, passing history on, helping future generations understand what your generation did and others.
Yeah.
Specifically from a prisoner of war perspective, what did that experience teach you about our country, about the value of freedom that you think people who come here to the museum should understand?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I don't know. Brokaw said it was the greatest generation. And I guess it was the greatest generation, but all the people that went to war, all people that supported the war, it was the greatest generation, you know. I hope we never have to go through anything like that again.
And if we do, we can look to the example you guys set. Is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
I'm thankful that I'm an American. I've been to so many foreign countries now since after the war and have seen different kinds of life. Nothing comes up to our standards. So I'm proud and love to be American.
I've got to ask you one more question.
Okay.
And if there's anything I left out, feel free to jump in. I bet you've been asked this before. You're 94 years young.
That's right.
How long are you going to keep coming here every Thursday afternoon at the Veterans Museum to volunteer?
As long as I can. As long as the good Lord allows me to. I've got one bad leg. I don't know how much longer it's going to last. But as long as I can walk, I'll be here.
And what do you get out of it? Where does the satisfaction come from for you?
There's so many people that know nothing about what happened, really, especially the young children, the younger people, you know. You just have to remind them, you know, because it was such an important part of our lives. Even though they didn't partake in it, they're realizing the results of all that effort, you know. So it's just an American way of life. Nothing like it.
And can't you tell that Al means that with every fiber of his 94-year-old body? If you find yourself on the Central California coast, I sure hope you'll go pay him a visit at the Veterans Museum there in San Luis Obispo. He's there every Thursday afternoon, and he can show you those plaques honoring the four men who went down with his plane. I also have photos of that for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I have a little postscript for you, too. I'm sure the feelings that Al has for Bill Fowler, that engineer who died trying to help the wounded gunners in the rear of the aircraft, left a powerful impression on you as they did on me. And with a little follow-up research, we've learned that while Bill was posthumously awarded the Purple Heart, he was not decorated for those selfless heroics that ultimately cost him his life. We're going to try our best to get that remedied, and we'll update you if and when that happens. And perhaps Al will have even more to share, because just a couple of days ago, 72 years after that tragic mission, he spoke for the first time with a member of Bill Fowler's family, a nephew who now knows much more about the uncle he never met, from someone who witnessed Bill's courage, his compassion, his heroism firsthand in the skies over Germany. So we can look forward to hopefully another chapter in this story, but we're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time of what Al Finley's Prisoner of War story illustrates in powerful fashion. Freedom is not free.